So what I try to promote is a system in place. It's 12 steps. Because, you know, there's only how many people are right for a job? You know, 10, 15 people. If they know you want to talk to them, they'll respond to you. You have to make them feel like it's you that I really want to talk to.
All right. Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitby, and I'm joined today by Alan Cutter. Alan is the founder and CEO of AC Lion, a Forbes-rated best recruiting firm in America, 4 years in a row. With 13 employees and offices in New York, Los Angeles, Atlanta, and Israel, AC Lion focuses on digital talent and builds leadership teams for growing companies from venture-backed startups to enterprise-level organizations. In addition to its core practice, Alan founded a recruitment innovation lab and investment arm, AC Lion Venture Partners, to invest in paradigm-shifting companies, including blockchain, autonomous, IoT, artificial intelligence, and mobile-first technology. Alan's a huge believer in life-work balance, relocating his wife and four kids to Israel 2.5 years ago. He volunteers for numerous community charities. He's an avid surfer and mountain biker. Alan, thanks for being here.
Hey, my pleasure, Mark. I'm super excited to be on the program and listen to your podcast for the past 2 weeks, mostly while I was mountain biking. So I loved to hear so many smart people around the room talking about recruiting, and I'm glad that you're doing this for the community.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Alan. I really appreciate that. So listen, how did you end up in Israel? Because you started the business in New York, I think.
Yeah, no, I'm in New York City. Yeah. Been in New York City for, you know, past. I grew up in Boston. Actually, right. Before that, even Ohio. I was an Ohio guy. First 8.5 years in Boston, then college in New York, and then a recruitment firm for the first 4 years, and then I started my own company. And then 2.5 years ago, it was something I've always wanted to do. You know, people have a bucket list of things that are important to them. Well, moving to Israel was one of those things.
Amazing. And this is actually a really interesting topic in a couple of aspects. One is, you know, you fulfilling a personal ambition and blending that with your business growth. And because a lot of companies try and expand internationally based in another country, and there's pros and cons to doing that, but you've actually gone to another location in order to set up shop, which is cool. I'd like to learn more about that. But also the whole idea of having remote offices, you did that pre-pandemic, obviously. And I feel like that could have been an advantage in some ways. But let's dig into that. Like, you started in the business in, was it 97?
Yeah.
Yeah.
May 1997. Well, no, I started my company in May 1997. Okay. I started recruiting in 1993.
Got it. Wow. Okay. So I started my recruiting career in 1997. So wow. You've got a few years on me. But
not many though, but an important four years, because when you started, people actually used computers.
Yeah. Right. Absolutely. Well, sort of.
You were pre-index cards, or did you actually have index cards?
We had both. We had the computer, but it was a dumb terminal. I had no internet, like outside right. connection to the internet.
Wow. See, that's something that we were always ahead of the game. So by 1997, we got the internet in my old company in like 1995.
Already. Oh, brilliant. Wow. You guys.
And that's ahead. Really. That's really part of my story, you know, and always ahead of technology. And so we used to run ads in the New York Times, www.otech.com. So people would open up the New York Times to read for job posting, for job ads, but then we would divert them to the internet.
Awesome.
So people would apply online. It was pretty amazing.
Yeah, that was way ahead of your time. So paint a picture for me of the company history then, like how it sort of evolved over the last 24 years.
Sure. I mean, I started in recruiting engineers in 1993 for a company called OTech. We were, you know, an 8-person company at the time. And when I left, we were 60 people. So it was in tremendous growth. We were the founders of hotjobs.com, which was really the first internet job board.
Oh, cool.
So the company was split between you know, traditional recruiters and the job board people.
Yeah.
We gave it away for free. They offered for me to be number two, which is essentially running hotjobs.com. Mm-hmm. The offer was $25,000 base salary, and I had to give up my desk, which was four recruiters at the time. I was making, you know, really good money for, you know, for someone who was like 26, 27 years old. And I said, I'm not giving up my desk, but I want to do this because, you know, I was one of the founding members of the company. There was no equity because no one really understood equity at the time. We were a bunch of recruiters. So, and I said, you know, let me start hotjobsisrael.com, you know, and instead of like sort of focusing on like the current business model, which I thought was great, I was already like two steps ahead. So I sent a proposal into them for Hot Jobs Israel, which is essentially like bringing people to Israel for technology jobs. And, you know, and they agreed to the proposal. Then there were these terrorist attacks in Israel and they said, forget it, we're not sending you there. It's too dangerous. And after they gave me the offer of basically, you know, 25K or nothing, I decided that that wasn't enough for me. And I left and I started the company with a partner, 50-50, had no recruiting experience whatsoever, just somebody that I met in my community. But he had a lot of grit. And he was a trader of baseball cards. And we started the business in my apartment for the first 2 weeks. He introduced me to one investor who gave me $30,000. I gave him 30% of the business, not equity. I said profit share. He was fine with that. And within 6 months, I had all his money back, and I started giving him his percentage. We did that for about a year. I was in 245 Park Avenue in the Helmsley Building overlooking New York City. Could not get better than that. But I was always like pushing for more technology and always had that Hot Jobs Israel thing in my mind that I wanted to run, and my partner was going to run the traditional recruiting piece. And after a year, like the investor said, you know, this is too much. You guys are like way ahead of the time. He was placing accountants. We parted ways. I found an office space on 35th Street, and I built the company from 97 to about 2001. I opened up a book called the New York New Media Association book. It was a bunch of little startup companies like Google and Facebook and 24/7 Media. And I'm like, hey, I'm young, you're young. I have engineers, you know, and I loved working with founders, and those companies became massive. DoubleClick, I mean, you name the tech company, we were placing the engineers. And that bug to this day has never left me. I always want to help startup founders at the earliest stage building out their teams. So that's the origination of the company.
Amazing, Alan. So why early stage founders? What is it that attracts you about that particular market?
It's a couple things. We all know what it's like, or what it used to be like, to work with sort of like the recruiters, the internal recruiters, or the people that sort of the gatekeepers, as people used to call them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they didn't really treat you like a partner, mm-hmm. you know, then in those days, at least. And the founders really appreciated what you could do for them. You know, they had a burning need. You were able to fulfill it, number one. And number two, I always had a keen interest in business. I believe that we have to hire people that have intellectual curiosity. Yes. So, you know, when I go to a cocktail party, I can talk to every single person in that room about what they do, and they think I know their business really well.
Right.
And that's like, cool. You know what I'm saying? Like, they're like, you know, it's jack of all trades, master of none, you know, that whole famous saying, but like, that's me. You know, I'm literally like jack of all trades, but I get excited when someone says, this is what I do, and I can totally guess what they make, where, you know, what level they're at, like who's their boss and all that stuff. So when I talk to a founder, I can help them understand what it is that they need. And not just from a talent perspective, but actually from a business perspective. And then I didn't really know. Honestly, at the time, I probably came from sense of insecurity because I had come from a company that had worked with like Goldman Sachs, and this was just boring. And I just thought that they'd hire me because I was young and they were young. That's how it started. But now it's a complete passion of mine. And to this day, if you look at our clientele, like they're all early stage companies that some of them have made it, some of them are massive now, and some of them are not. And it's exciting to me.
I totally get that. And by the way, you can always spot the recruiter in the cocktail party because he's interviewing everybody, right? There's something about the ability to truly make an impact. It's one thing placing talent, and that's always gratifying at some level, but where you know that the people you're placing are going to have a massive impact on the trajectory of a business, and where the other thing about founders is they think big and they're open to fresh ideas, right? And to they don't have that bureaucracy or institutional mindset yet, and so I feel like it's much easier to truly consult with them. But also the old, adage in recruiting, success about urgency, urgency, urgency. And if there's enormous pressure on them to grow, then, it's almost like a recruiter's dream. There must be downsides too, though, right? Like what are the
disadvantages? I'll give you a quick story because it happened yesterday. Yeah. And I love the fact that I can tell a story about what is so gratifying about recruiting 24 years later, based on this exact subject. So just yesterday, I'm on the phone with a client who's a CEO of a company, and I'm dealing with their head of people, who, by the way, is amazing. And now I've changed my philosophy on head of people. I think they're very consultative right now, and they understand the value of a recruiter and their partners, how they partner with you. She was on the phone, and they needed a head of marketing. But they were trying to get it all up in one bundle. And here they are, an Israeli company focusing on the United States. I'm in Israel, but my team's in New York. So he feels totally connected to me because I understand what they're going through, where I used to not. Nobody can. And they need someone who's in the United States, but who feels the team and the engineering team and the product team, but they need to take that message out in the marketplace. Yeah. And they need to go raise money. And he's being honest with me. He's like, I need to raise that next round of financing. I need someone who's going to be, I'm Israeli. I can barely speak English, right? I need the face of the company. Can I find a face of the company that also knows how to market, also knows how to do social media, also knows how to do PR, that can like do that all for $150,000. And I'm like, no, this is what you need to do. And I'm literally telling him what he should do, what they should pay the person, what the title should be, I'm listening to his priorities, and I'm telling him, listen, based on what you said, I think you can get one and two, but you're probably not going to get three. The three you need to outsource. Mm-hmm. And he was like, this was incredible advice, Alan. So I never felt more gratified, number one. Yeah. Number two, I think I have him for life, right? He's not going to use other recruiters. He's going to only want to work with us. And now, I can call him, text him 3 seconds, and he's going to listen to what I have to say. So to this day, it's still my philosophy, but that's 24 years of experience. Now I actually can tell him what's worked and what doesn't work.
Totally. Now, Alan, what do you
think? So you asked me about the downside. Should I tell you about the downside?
Please.
Okay. The downside is very clear, and COVID was that downside. When you're working with early stage companies, they're based on VC funding. And if their VCs say, so many of them were on the cusp of raising a Series A, a Series B. Yeah. It just went completely cold. And they're like, listen, they didn't go out of business. Most of my clients, I think 100% of my clients stayed in business, which is great. They just went on freeze. Yeah. And that put us on freeze. So that's the downside. That is the downside. The second downside is that candidates don't always want to go to early stage companies. Mm-hmm. So it makes it much harder to pitch and get them excited about it. So your level of recruiter, your need to tell the story has to be perfecto. Mm. And I believe you can get candidates interested, but if you're just transactional, hey, I got a job for you, and an email, early stage companies, delete, no one's going to respond.
Let's double click on that, Alan, because I feel like incredibly quickly the pendulum has swung from 2020 was the year of we need more clients, focusing on business development. And the pendulum swung back to extreme candidate, driven environment where, again, it's hard to find the talent rather than to get the clients. What do you feel? And I'm sure that's amplified with what you do, but I think all recruiters can relate to this challenge of in getting candidate engagement, because it's easier than ever before to identify the talent and even to find their contact information. But in some ways, it's harder than ever before to get an actual conversation. What do you think that you guys do especially well or do differently in order to, you know, create that candidate engagement and get people interested, even to join a company they've never heard of before?
I love that question. It's one of my favorite questions because, you know why? Our clients ask that question all the time. And if they don't ask, I make them ask that question because that's the reason why they should use us. You know, you talk about the USP. What's your USP? Like I say, anyone could go on LinkedIn. Forget about the job. They used to say, oh, anyone could post a job. Forget it. They're smarter now, right? They have their internal recruiters. They all know. They used to work on the agency side. They all know how to go out and look for the candidates. They even know how to send them messages, right? So one of the things that I did during COVID is I hired a coach. His name is Jason Hill, and he suggested a book by Tom Erb. I don't know if you ever heard of him before.
No.
ERB. Okay, okay. Good. Good to know.
I'm adding it to my reading list as we speak. Yeah. Tom Erb.
It's kind of like the smallest book you'll ever read. It's $10 on, you know, on Amazon, whatever, you know, you can read it online. And it's, I think it's called like the 12 steps.
Okay.
And, you know, if you know about SaaS, they talk about 7 steps. But in recruiting, it used to be like, you know, 1-2 steps, make the call, cold call. Then it was an email marketing campaign. You know, we all know how many emails, 3 emails, right?
Yeah.
Mark before you kind of give up. But today you have to do like 12 steps. Uh-huh. So, and this is both, this will go both on the candidate side and on the client side. We're talking about the candidate side right now. So yeah, we have email marketing campaigns, no question about it. But then it's getting the person's phone number, making the phone calls, but it's email, 2 emails, then a phone call, then another email. You let them know that you're going to give them a call. And eventually they see that you really want to talk to them. Mm-hmm. The reason that people don't respond, and there's only one reason that they don't respond, is because they're smart. Today, people are smart. They don't fall for this email marketing, you know, campaign crap. They know it. They know it's spam. Mm-hmm. Even if it says your first name. Okay, mm-hmm. We don't recruit. We're not recruiting, you know, people that just started working yesterday. So yeah. And if you tried to customize every single email, which of course it would take 45 minutes.
Yeah.
Right. So that's another big waste of time. So what I try to promote people is a system in place. It's 12 steps.
Yeah.
And if there's someone that you really want to talk to, and cause you know, there's only how many people are right for a job, you know, 10, 15 people. If they know you want to talk to them, they'll respond to you. You have to make them feel like it's you that I really want to talk to.
Absolutely. I think that's, you've put that really, really well. So it is much more of a campaign approach, and it's a mindset shift from, okay, I'm going to call 3 times. I might, you know, send a few emails, and if I don't reach them, then I'm moving on. And I love the fact that you've said, well, that's actually 12 steps. It's a much, there's a lot more persistence involved. And I feel like if we combine persistence with creativity, then it could really get above the noise and make someone feel, well, I guess these guys really are targeting me specifically. And it's not just a mass approach.
Right. So I did yesterday, just funny enough, it happened yesterday, one of my recruiters, you know, cause they never know a pearl of wisdom is going to come out of my mouth. She's been recruiting for a couple of years, but she works for us now. She's only more than a year. I said, you know, put a video message, you know, out. And I know people do this, but I said, you can create the message just like an email and then insert the person's name. But because it's a video, they're not going to be as like, oh, it's, because you can't mass email a video. You can't.
Yeah.
So obviously, hey, Mark, there's this great opportunity. And she said to me, and I actually wanted, this was on my list to ask you, do you say the name of the company, especially when you're in a video? Because in the email, people don't expect it so much. But in a video, it's like, we're working with a venture-backed company with hired 200 people last year, and they're in fintech. That's not going to get someone. You got to say the name of the company. Now, where contingency recruiters are always afraid they're going to send it out to their friends and people are going to apply and they go around the recruiter. What do you think, Mark?
So that's really interesting. Because in general, my advice is say the name of the company once the candidate has engaged with you. They've taken the bait, so to speak, and now you're reeling them in. Now you have to be a little bit, put your cards on the table to get, you know, secure their real interest in moving forward. I think it's a mistake for recruiters to withhold the name until like as long as possible, because it doesn't set up a trust-based, you know, it's like, I've got the information and I'm asking you all these questions, but I'm not willing to give you information in return, which I don't think inspires that, you know, that trust with the candidate. What you're saying is you give the company name right up front. I feel like if it's a retained search and you have the relationship with the client, then you're pretty safe to do that. But what's your rationale?
Right. So I'm not saying that I do it 100%. I'm saying that we need to A/B test it, and we are A/B testing it because think about all. I think the risk in someone submitting themselves versus the risk of all the people that are not going to respond and all that time that you spend of banging your head against the wall because people, again, it's customization, it's transparency, and you're honoring the fact that you're not wasting their time. Mm-hmm. And people are very crazy about their time. They don't want to talk to recruiters the way they used to want to talk to recruiters. And we have to be honest with ourselves about that, you know, and maybe you'll disagree with me, but I know the mindset of a typical candidate right now. Their mindset is, I have all these platforms, you know, there's all this AI stuff. There's plenty of ways for me to look for a job. There are real people at real recruiters at companies that I'm dealing with every day. A independent recruiter that gets paid a fee. They understand how that works, and they know that they think that possibly I'm going to be better off without the fee because there's, you know, they've been around the block. You say, here's the company, and you do it in the email. This is exactly what I said to this person. If you do it in the email, they still can feel like this is some sort of mass email, mm-hmm. and they could just say cool information. I'm going to suit myself. You're not a real person to them. I'm not screwing a real person. They see you in the face. Hi, I'm Jennifer. You know, I want to bring you, John, this opportunity. They're going to be like, okay, you know what? She's a real person. I'm going to call her back. And you say, please call me back. I want to tell you about the opportunity. I don't want to waste your time. I want you to take a look at it, mm-hmm. you know, and I still think you can say I've been retained because that doesn't mean you've been exclusively retained.
Right. I hear you. So this is really interesting because what you're saying is the risk of not giving full disclosure is that you're going to lose a candidate you might have otherwise placed because
they won't respond.
They don't respond.
Yes.
Versus the risk of, you know, word might get out and a few people might apply directly to the business. And you're saying that, okay, I get it now. That makes sense.
It's a new world. That has shifted because we're in a digital world now and more people don't, your response rate, I'm sure you've looked at what your response rate is on LinkedIn and people have response rates and stuff like that.
Yeah.
The more transparent you are, the more real you are, you'll have a better response rate.
Amazing. So video, do you know what's awesome is that what we're talking about could apply equally to recruiting and business development in the sense of having this 12-step mindset, you know, using a variety of channels and being creative. So the video email is a great example. Do you guys hold, like I've seen some people, I've not tried this myself, hold up a poster with the person's name on it. So it would say Alan, like a whiteboard or something, and you've got Alan so that when they see the video thumbnail, they know conclusively it's for them, whereas it could just be a generic marketing video from the thumbnail.
I've never thought of that. So I would love to see that. I think that's a great idea. We're not at that sophisticated point yet, mm-hmm. but if you ask me like where recruiting is going, that's where it's going. There's a company called Easy Movie that I just started working with. They're not designed for recruiters, but they are a sales enablement video technology company that allows people like us to create videos that are relatively, you know, sort of like an email marketing campaign for video, quickly insert whatever. And I think that's for sure where things are going from a BD perspective. You know, I've heard a lot of podcasts here about video interviewing and stuff like that. And there are better people to talk to about, but I think video pitching, both on the candidate side and on for the BD side, is going to be huge. Recruiters need to start becoming comfortable with these types of situations, putting their content on video. I admit I may look comfortable, but you know, I had a glass of whiskey before this call. You know, I had to loosen myself up, you know.
So. It's funny. I think like, but here's the thing. It doesn't matter if it's outside your comfort zone, all the more reason to do it, because it means fewer people are going to put themselves out there like that, right? And it allows you to stand out. I don't like being on video like this, but I understand that it's good for my business and it builds relationship with my clients and my audience. And that's why I force myself to do it. It's not like I've got a face for radio. So I think, you know,
I gotta tell you, I think you're brilliant.
Oh,
thank you so much. I think the way you listen and the way you dig deeply. So I really do strive. I believe that it's people like you that were nervous at first, that just put themselves out there, that give inspiration to people like me who are much better one-on-one, who could talk forever one-on-one and say really smart things. But as soon as they put that video camera on, they clam up. You just got to go out there and do it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Have you guys tried the audio message feature in LinkedIn for like leaving a voicemail message via LinkedIn?
Actually, no. Tell me about it.
Yeah, give it a try, because it's it only works on mobile. So, but you could leave, it's basically like leaving a voicemail message, but it drops an audio file in the person's, DM feed on LinkedIn. So you can do it pretty quickly.
Yeah, it leaves it in the feed. Yes.
Go ahead.
I have a belief about LinkedIn, mm-hmm. that it's becoming kind of a very spam kind of network.
Yeah.
So I think the audio thing is something we should do more of, mm-hmm. but I also think that it's at the level that we're looking for, not so many people check LinkedIn the way they used to check LinkedIn.
Yeah.
So we're starting to do more, you know, email marketing directly. Yeah. And I should have mentioned this with the 12 steps. I meant to, but part of the 12 steps is LinkedIn. So LinkedIn is part of it. So
yes.
Email, LinkedIn, voicemail. It's never, I 99% of the time, no one's going to pick up the call. No matter what, I don't care. In my industry, people aren't picking up calls. They're just not. I don't pick up calls. I hate when people call me. And then here I am telling people to call people. If I don't recognize the number, I'm just not picking up the call. And no one's calling me to say, I have a job order for you. It's very rare. It's like never going to happen. You know, if they do, they'll leave a message and I'll call them back.
Yeah.
But that still doesn't happen. So for me, it's the voicemail.
Yeah.
So I do agree with the audio, but it's not going to be the thing that's going to get people to call you back. It's going to be the whole package of them knowing that you want to reach them out.
So that's interesting.
I'm glad I'm going to do it. I'm going to do this audio thing, but it's going to be one of my steps.
Exactly. Yeah. There is no one thing that is like the silver bullet that is going to get everyone to reply back. It's the combined effect of that multi-touch, multi-channel campaign. Mm-hmm. But you're the first person I think I've heard say this, where you're calling not because you expect them to pick up, because you want them to hear your voice, and it reinforces the overall impression that you really want to speak to them.
Yeah. And I'll tell you what makes that so unique too, and why I'm now able to get my recruiters to do it. I once brought in a guy to talk about cold calling, you know, typical sales trainer and all the tricks of getting someone on the phone. And if people had like barf buckets in front of them, they'd be barfing all over themselves. they hated it. The interview was so, the feedback was so negative.
Oh dear.
Because, you know, again, my people are millennials. They're good writers. They like to email. That's how they're social selling. Yeah. And the idea of picking up the phone was no way. But when I tell them that, they're not going to pick up the phone. They're just going to hear your voice. Right. And then they're much more comfortable and it will show them that they're not going to. So like, I'm just going to give them a voicemail. I learned this from Tom Erb, and he also says to call people early in the morning. Brilliant, right? 5:30 a.m. Oh, well, fine, whatever. But you know, like early in the morning before they get to their desk, because I don't check my voicemail during the day. But I do check it in the morning when I, you know, get to my desk. People come, they have their coffee, they'll get their emails, checking their voicemail, and they're like, hey, listen, so I know you're not going to pick up the call anyways. It's early in the morning, but I wanted to let you know I'm thinking about you. I sent you an email yesterday. You know, I'm going to send you another email. I'd like you to respond. I don't want to keep, I want to show you that I want to reach you, professional persistence, stuff like that. I have great candidates for you or whatever it may be.
Yes. All right. So listen, Alan, shout out to Alexis. This tip is for you because I've got, in my coaching group, Alan, I've got people ranging from sort of, I'm going to want to say 20, you know, mid late 20s to early 60s. So there's like a whole range of ages here. And one of my clients is, you know, prefers that social selling for both clients and candidates. And this little shift in the way you perceive the call, I think could really help. To frame it differently. Yeah. But what about,
and by the way, the other tip I'm going to do, because I think number one that people say is, what's your USP? When clients ask you, how are you different than everybody else?
Yeah.
Use this. Like if you say, we have a 12-step process, we don't give up. We show our candidates that we don't give up. And the difference between us and maybe your recruiters, and again, your recruiters are great, you know, but A is our niche. We understand your business in the industry focus or the functional focus. Mm-hmm. So, but B, we also know who the people are that are going to be right for the job. And they know who we are. So our name is recognized. Mm-hmm. It already gives us a chance they're going to call us back. Mm-hmm. But then if we show them that we're also persistent, we want to speak to them, all that together is going to combine with them responding to us. And that's ultimately the game. The game is responding. Once I give this candidate to you, you're right. You could probably handle it from there. But getting to that point, it's really hard. And we got that.
I love it. And Alan, in terms of the USP, I feel like you should brand or name that process, you know, your 12-step process. Give it a name like, you know, the AC Lion something or other, right? And that way it's proprietary to you. You could even put a TM on it, and that's part of your intellectual property and your sort of trade secrets that you bring to bear on behalf of your clients, that you have this proven, you know, 12 or however many steps you want in there system for engaging with top talent and bringing people to the table who nobody else is going to be able to get.
Love it. Thank you for that. The AC Lion steps.
Exactly. Before I go to my next question, I'd like to share one of the keys to my success in recruitment and in business. You may have noticed that a lot of the people I interview on this show have a coach. That's not a coincidence. Most high achievers have a coach, including me. I've worked with various coaches over the last 20 years, and it's been a huge factor in my own personal and business growth. Here's why. Sometimes it's hard to see the forest for the trees, and it really helps to take a step back and look at how you can improve the business and get a fresh outside perspective from someone who's bringing new ideas and insights to the table. Plus, as a business owner, who is holding you accountable and helping you stay on track? So I want to encourage you, if you're not already working with a coach, get one. It doesn't have to be me. There are plenty of amazing coaches out there. Just find someone who you believe will add measurable value to your business and can help you get to the next level. If you do want to explore a coaching relationship with me, then you're welcome to apply for a free 30-minute strategy session at recruitmentcoach.com/breakthrough. This is not a sales call. My number one objective is to help you to get clear on your goals, identify the roadblocks that are holding you back, and create a strategic plan to increase your billings and grow your business. I promise you'll leave our session feeling focused, re-energized, and excited to take your business to the next level. You can apply at recruitmentcoach.com/breakthrough. You said something, candidates don't want to talk to recruiters the way they used to. Could you elaborate on what you mean by that?
Sure. I mean, I think they assume that everything is very transactional right now. Mm-hmm. I think today's, look, there's so much information and data coming at people.
Yeah.
I can't even keep up with my WhatsApp, Telegram, text messages, emails from multiple. I have like 15 email accounts. So Facebook, LinkedIn, I mean, you know, Instagram, TikTok, right? So I don't, it's not that I think people are saying I won't talk to this person, but they're getting so many messages. Mm-hmm. So A, it's the amount of data that's coming at people. B, people are much more, what's the word, like, you know,
skeptical.
Negative is the word. Yes, yeah, exactly.
Guarded.
Skeptical, guarded. Mm. But no, there was another word that I wasn't, but it doesn't matter. And so they've had a bad experience. You always hear it. Oh, I've had such bad experiences with recruiters. So, oh, wow, you're the best. So they immediately expect that they're going to try to like sell them on that one opportunity, which is another thing that I try to coach my recruiters. And it's another A-B testing thing, which is some people say lead with a specific opportunity, you know, because it looks like you have a specific opportunity for one person. But I'm much more of a fan of I want to be your eyes and ears on the railroad track. This is what I do. I place SaaS sellers. You're a SaaS seller. I'm connected to lots of companies. I understand how things can move up in a career. Let's set up a 15-minute call at some point at your convenience. Then all of a sudden, it's like, you should know me because I'm someone that can help you in your career at some point. That to me is, again, consultative. You have to imagine the mindset of that person. So yeah, they don't want to talk to me. You have to have a lot of grit or a big wall to understand that, but also understand that once they do, they'll be yours forever. Mm. So how do you put yourself in that mindset that they're guarded, that they have a lot of data come to, that they're very busy, and don't take it personally and try to get them on the call because you know they're going to be yours afterwards.
Absolutely. I love it. And do you always do it that way, or you use a mixture of both approaches, Alan, in your business?
Yeah, we're a big fan of using both approaches. Yeah. You know, I wish I had a chief data analyst or a CTO at my company because they could be show me what works and what doesn't work all the time.
Right.
But my gut feeling is we got to mix it up all the time and then just see how what works and what doesn't work.
Yeah. No, that makes total sense. Tell me, like, you've been doing this a long time and you've been through all the economic cycles, 2001, 2008, COVID. I actually launched my business in 2001, September 2001.
Wow.
And
September what?
Yeah, well, September 1st. And
wow.
And then within 2 weeks, the whole world was different. And, you know, that was just a crazy time. So you were there as well during that time. Then 2008, I almost went under. That was not fun. And then just recently, we've had this global pandemic. You know, from your perspective, where's the recruitment industry going from here?
Okay, so for the past couple of years, I've been talking about the disruption of recruiters. You know, we work with early stage companies that disrupt industries in general. That's all they do, right? Whether it's the brokers or matchmakers or industry, whatever industry that there is a broker, accountants, law firms, we have the platform that disrupts that, right? And we place people in recruitment platforms that disrupt recruiters. I've been on panels where people have said the recruiters are going to die. So I pride myself on always looking and not only looking, but I've been investing in early stage HR, you know, recruitment technology companies because I want to hedge and I want to merge technology with the recruitment industry. So if you ask me like a year ago, do I think recruiting is going to be around for a long time? I'd say yes, but it has to be combined with technology. And I don't believe that we're going to be able to charge the same fees that we can. Mm-hmm. I'm a big believer in retain recruiting needing to be disrupted and will be disrupted. So I look at where there's white space. I think the contingency marketplace has already been disrupted way before COVID. And companies understand the math of if they can hire internal recruiters, it's better to go pay someone, you know, $150,000 maybe or $130,000 and take a really good person from an agency as opposed to where they used to take the C players, right? Okay, so I lost a C player. They went internal. They didn't really understand how much money they can make. But now they're getting A plus, even A minus players for sure, which are your really top billers, not your top, but your second tier top. And I think what COVID did is it accelerated that. Okay. COVID accelerated because people realized that they can't be spending the money. Whenever there's a downturn, whenever the money is tight, they look at the fees. The first thing they look at.
Yep.
So they looked at the fees and they said, we got to hire more recruiters from agencies. They found the weakness in the agency models because we were having a hard time, and they picked off some great people. Mm-hmm. I think the agencies have lost many, many more people than they want to admit that they're mm-hmm. willing to lose. I think companies smartened up and they paid money, a lot more money than they ever would have paid for an internal recruiter. Mm-hmm. So recruiting, our industry is definitely moving more towards building internal agencies within companies. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you've ever heard that term before, but in fact, they're even buying recruiting firms now, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's really smart. It's a great exit strategy for owners. What I do believe, and COVID taught me this, because I believed that we were going to be disrupted. But now that I saw that it went completely dead to we're busy again, like we've never been busy before, it just proved me slightly wrong, right? Because they are willing to pay fees still.
Yes.
Right? So you have to sit back and ask yourself, why are they willing to pay fees when they have their own internal teams, right? And the answer is very, very simple. It's niche, it's function, it's them not being able to recruit enough recruiters, so they're all really, really busy. So you have to find the companies that are busy. You have to prove to them that you are smart, that you know what you're doing, that you're the niche person, and then they'll pay you the fees.
Right.
And you got to be creative with your models. 100% creativity with your business models. I know I've heard that on your podcast before, but if you're just going to be a one trick pony, I'm not sure you're going to be around. I think you could survive the next year or two, but there will be another downturn, and you need to be fully prepared with multiple business models. And if you can't do that, then you need to either merge with another company that can or partner with other companies that do and offer that to your clients. Because recruiters are afraid to use new business models because either the recruiters feel like they're not going to make money or they're still willing to pay their fees. So that's where we're at right now.
All right. Okay. Interesting. Alan, can you elaborate what you mean by alternative business models?
Sure. So I think like providing like list of candidates that are pre-vetted, interested in the company, ready to be interviewed, which we both know is the hardest part, one of the hardest parts of recruiting. We don't want to give that away for nothing. We're afraid to do that. But we started doing that during COVID, you know, and we came up, we sat for hours. I mean, we really spent back and forth, debated it, thought, you know, like you wouldn't believe it. And we came up with a model, whatever it is, depending on the position, the level of position, here's a dollar amount for X number of candidates that we're going to provide for you. So let's say it's $10,000 for 6 qualified candidates at under 150K. Mm-hmm. Over 150K, it's going to be more like 15,000 for 6. You want 3 more, it's going to be another X couple thousand dollars. And what that does is it allows you to focus on sourcing and get that 12-step process down. You're guaranteed cash, right, which is great. And then you move on to the next one. And if they get placed, great. If they don't get placed, that's okay too, because you provided them the information that they need.
Okay, interesting. So is that's more of a flat fee model per
project.
A specific piece of the recruiting process.
Yeah, and our philosophy, and it kind of goes back to my candidate philosophy before about how you're going to lose more people by not providing the name of the company than if you didn't. It's the same thing as we understand you don't use recruiters. So we're not a recruiter. We are I'm never going to use a sourcing company. We will provide you with qualified candidates. We're using our expertise to do that. RPO, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. And we're going to be there for you. We can do more steps and you can pay us for those steps. So if you don't want to pay us for those extra steps, pay us for the first 5 or 6 steps. Mm-hmm. And then we'll build a relationship with you. And then you're going to give us those harder to fill roles, the ones that you need us there the whole way through.
Interesting. Okay, awesome. Any other examples, Alan, of how you might disrupt or approach this business differently?
Yeah, so we're doing a lot with diversity right now. A number of firms are too. And the thing I've learned about myself is I can't build technology. I thought I could. I tried to build my own ATS system back in 2001, but you just have to put millions of dollars into it. So what I'm doing is, and especially I'm doing this in Israel, is I'm finding a group of engineers that have a great product, and I'm bringing the business side to the product. I make a great product manager. So I hooked up with a company that is developing a diversity technology for sourcing based on the idea that you can't use Boolean searches. People don't put their skills down if they're, maybe they come from a different kind of background. You can't search African-American on LinkedIn. It's just, you can't do that.
Right.
And what's also, it's illegal. It's discriminatory to actually search and look for pictures of people that might be African-American or women. That's actually illegal and discriminatory. And one day, very soon, it's going to start coming back to that balance where all of a sudden white males are going to be a minority. Or what about people who are older, or people come from certain religious or ethnic backgrounds, or even political views. I'm a big believer in diversity of thought. True diversity is all diversity. So this, when you search on this technology, you do not see pictures. The machine gives you the answers, and you are picking the people without any unconscious bias, because it removes all ideas of what the ethnicity would be or the minority. And you, once you press approve, it's recorded that you approve that person. So if you then don't select that person to interview, then it's something that you can go back and audit. So we send that full audit report to the company, and they saw how we actually recruited the people. And then if they end up hiring, let's just say they end up hiring a white male for the role, but they interviewed 6 females, 4 African Americans, 2 disabled people, whatever it may be, then there is a reason that happened potentially. That makes sense.
So, Alan, is this technology available now, or this is something you're working on?
Yeah, it's available. No. It's we've been working with them for about a year, and our model is ridiculously low for diversity. We're kind of giving it away for free. It's not free. It's $5,000. Right. But for $5,000, you get five diversity candidates for $5,000. Very simple.
Wow.
That's incredible. All our emails, we talk about diversity, and when people don't respond, we say, are you not interested in diversity and hiring for diversity candidates? We literally say that, and people are like, oh, I'm interested.
Hilarious. So, we can include a link to this in the show notes, Alan, but like, is this your proprietary technology, or
no? It's not. So we really have to do like AC Lion, just come to us,
yeah.
And because they've allowed us to white label it, which is really great. The deal that we have with this company is that they go after Fortune 500 companies, Fortune 1000 companies, and that's never been our thing,
right?
And we go after early stage.
Got it.
And an interesting, it's not a statistic, but it's just more of a knowledge. Anything under 100 people, they're really not interested in diversity, in my opinion. They say they are, but they're going to have to find whoever they can find, Once you get past 100, even 200, so we specialize in the diversity side between 2 and 400 people. They still don't have like someone who's in charge of diversity. It's really important to them. And now they can afford, because the big misnomer about diversity is you're not getting everything you want plus diversity. Right? You're going to get something very different.
Yes.
But you're going to get something better and more creative. And, and people don't get that. They say they want diversity, but they really don't when it comes down to it, unless you're giving them everything they want. They're not biased. They're not just, they are not biased company. They just, they're looking out for their business. And I need to try to educate them that you are looking out for your business by hiring someone that may not have 2 years from Bain or went to Harvard, but maybe they were the captain of their softball team or whatever it may be, or,
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, I get that totally. One more thing I wanted to ask you, Alan. And by the way, before I do, we should give a shout out to David Bernstein because he was the one that connected
us. That's right.
So thanks, David, for making the introduction.
Thank you, David.
I'm really glad you did. You've been managing people and managing building teams and managing recruiters for, you know, over 20 years. How has that changed over time in terms of how you manage sales teams, recruiting teams, and that sort of thing?
So I've learned so much from the people that I've hired, and they've taught me actually to be a better manager. What I thought worked, you know, that I stuck to certain principles, I think they've taught me. So again, shout out to my millennial partners out there who, for example, we started having people work from home way before COVID, and they thought it was important. They awesome. Wanted to give people, you know, a lot more vacation time because they felt that was important. Yes. We just started paying people base salaries versus draws, which I was a big fan of draws, and they were convincing me that you got to pay people base salaries. Yes. It's a new way of thinking because they didn't feel like we were investing in them with a draw. I'm like, but we're paying them a draw. They're like, no, you got to pay them a base salary, just like everybody else in the world gets paid.
Yeah.
And I learned from them, and we're doing that now. And that was something we worked on during COVID. So it's about listening and about empowering and about being transparent, but truly not just saying that you're transparent, but really letting them know what's going on. You know, if we're not doing well, here's what's happening, and being real with them. And they appreciate that.
Absolutely. That all makes total sense. It's interesting because I've got clients in the UK and Europe and also in Asia Pacific and the United States. And vacation time in Europe is way more, like just the normal statutory, like legal requirement for vacation time is way more than in Canada and the United States. And yet, you know, and I've not looked at the, you know, but I'm guessing that if you looked at the productivity of a recruiter in, you know, in the UK versus a productivity recruiter in the US, that they're comparable. So, you know, is restricting someone's, like saying you can only have 2 weeks vacation, do you really get more output from that person? I would argue probably not. What's your thoughts on that?
We actually did a full year research study again pre-COVID about this. And what that research study was really asking all our, you know, recruitment, you know, HR people within their own companies, what their philosophy is.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because we there was a sense that unlimited vacation was where all our tech companies were moving towards. And what we discovered is that that's actually not true, that people have tried unlimited vacations and they feel that it backfires on people because they feel that they can't take time off all the time.
Yeah.
So I think it's important to give people set vacations.
Yeah.
At the same time, you have to expand that. I think, you know, the whole, everything shouldn't be like calling in sick, that kind of thing. It should be like, so something like 3 weeks is nice, at least 3 weeks, but then, you know, Friday's off. And the other thing is just do your job, you know what I mean? And, you know, earn vacations. So we have like rewards, you can earn a vacation day for certain things that you do and stuff like that. And if you're at the end of your vacation days, you know, we can talk about it. And then what we created was based on, it's all about a path. Recruiters don't create a path for people. That's the number one reason why people leave recruiting firms is because they don't understand the path. So the other thing we worked on in COVID is, you know, we have recruiting associates, coordinators, recruiting associates, recruiters, executive recruiters, senior executive recruiter, associates director, director, and we're a relatively small company, but within that comes vacation days, more vacation days and more flexibility and things like that. So we can show people that as you move up, you get certain benefits.
Love it. Well, look, that could be part two of our conversation, Alan, because I think that's a whole interesting thing to talk about is actually how do you grow and scale a recruiting firm? And we didn't get a chance to cover that today. So hopefully we can
go another round. Maybe you can teach me how to do that.
Well, let's talk. Alan, just before you go, can I ask one more question? Because
yeah, I'm not going anywhere.
All right. It came up at the beginning and I forgot to circle back to this life work balance thing and living in Israel.
Yeah.
And, you know, so could you expand on why that was so important to you and how it's actually worked out?
So my wife and I always wanted to do it. We were living in Long Beach, New York, right on the beach. I was a big surfer. I had a great life. Absolutely loved it. Took a 55-minute commute on the train to New York City every day. So I had the best of both worlds. But it was something I always wanted to do. I would travel to Israel back and forth like at least 5 or 6 times a year.
Okay.
But living there was just something that we wanted to do. There also happens to be like a major tech scene here. Like it's like the Silicon Valley of the world.
Yeah.
And I felt that I would have an ability to kind of be the face of my company in Israel and help international companies come to the US, which is something we always did. But by being there, by being where the engineering teams are, would be a big advantage for AC Lion. So in a way, I thought that was my spin, not my spin, but my way of rationalizing to my company why I'm leaving. Because I think I felt that people would say, wow, the CEO is leaving, the company's falling apart, like what's going on? So while we told our friends and family we were moving, I still had not told my company. Mm-hmm. I felt like I was quitting. It was like really traumatic. I had only quit once in my life, and that's how it felt like again. Mm-hmm. And you know what I did was I empowered a few people. I elevated them to partnership. I gave them percentages of the business. I did all that before I even made that announcement. So along that announcement came empowering of other people that were already empowered, but now they were really given full responsibilities to run the day-to-day. Mm-hmm. And I was going to be the person that would be bringing in the business and really doing thought leadership, stuff like that. So that went over pretty well. And I also said I'm trying it out for a year, mm-hmm. you know, and I came back once every 5 weeks. I came back for 10 days.
Great.
So I kind of lived both worlds, and it was really amazing. And it worked. And the other thing we did is we got everybody laptops. And because I was, even though we had people working from home before, they were in a way second-class citizens. You know, it was always like the New York office. That's where we had the food. That's where we had the birthday parties. That's where we had all the events. And the other people kind of felt like, what about us? And as the CEO, all of a sudden, I felt how they felt. So we made sure everybody got laptops. Everything was on the cloud. We spent a significant amount of money when COVID came. Working from home was, and I also put in work from home policies beforehand too.
Awesome.
So it was the fact that I moved actually cultivated that. And now all of a sudden, now that we're in COVID, it's like no big deal that I'm in Israel. And it's not a big deal that I'm not flying back and forth either, because nobody cares about meeting anybody anymore. Everything's on Zoom. So it worked out nicely for me.
Once again, you were 2 years ahead of the curve there, Alan.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, listen, thanks for bookending that story, because I think that is a paradigm shift that many other people are starting to wake up to, is the fact that you don't have to be necessarily in New York or London or LA or whatever to run your business or to serve your clients. So that could be another interesting topic for another day. But thank you so much. Really enjoyed this.
Hey, Mark, I really enjoyed it. Thanks so much. Good luck with everything.
Thank you for listening to The Resilient Recruiter. I know how busy recruiters are, so I'm honored that you're investing this time with me each week. I don't take your attention for granted. That's why I'm going all out to deliver value for you here, real insights you can apply to improve your business. And if you really want to help me to reach a wider audience and impact more people, please consider leaving the show a review on Apple Podcasts. And if you leave me a review, please reach out and let me know so I can thank you personally. Please hit the subscribe button, and I'll see you next time.